I'd like to thank everybody for joining this call on domestic torture and repression in the United States. We're happy to have with us two seasoned activists and organizers who are going to do the bulk of the presenting. That's Bonnie Kernis, who's with the American Friends Service Committee, particularly with the committee's Prison Watch Project. And we also have with us Natsu Saito, who's a professor of law at Georgia State University and teaches international law in several other fields. And so we're going to go on and get ahead and get started with the presentation. Just let me make sure that everyone who needs to be unmuted is unmuted.
And Kelly, how long do you want us to talk for initially?
10 minutes each.
Okay.
Okay, so we're ready to go. I believe it was Natsu first, and then Bonnie second.
I think it was Bonnie first.
Okay, I mean, Bonnie?
Maybe not.
Hello, Bonnie?
Yes.
There you go.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. Okay, greetings, everyone. Since 1975, I've served as a human rights advocate on behalf of people in prison throughout the country, coordinating the Prison Watch Project for the American Friends Service Committee in Newark. Many of the men that I take testimony from call their imprisonment the war at home or neo-slavery, using captive or imprisoned human beings to socially incapacitate, to politically repress, to generate income, and as a labor force, as an integral part of what we know as the U.S. prison industrial complex. How do you describe desperation to someone who is not desperate? Began a letter to me from U.S. political prisoner Ojeri Latulo, who went on to depict everyone in the management control unit at Trenton State Prison being awakened by guards dressed in riot gear, holding barking dogs at 1 a.m. every other morning. Once awakened, the prisoners were forced to strip, gather their belongings while feeling the dogs straining at their leashes, snapping at them. He described being terrorized, intimidated, and the humiliation of being naked and not knowing whether the masked guards were male or female. If we think back to images of slavery and to images of the civil rights movement, we begin to understand that dogs have been used as a device of torture for hundreds of years in the United States. When what happened at Abu Ghraib shocked the world, more than 2.5 million prisoners, their families, advocates, lawyers, and activists understood that this was business as usual. Perhaps one of the most egregious forms of torture that the U.S. engages in is the use of extended sensory deprivation in isolation cages. Control units first surfaced in the 1970s and 80s, when we received hundreds of reports from people saying that they were being held in isolation because of their political beliefs and ability to organize. These were members of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the American Indian Movement, white anti-imperialists, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, prisoner activists, many of whom were Muslim. In response to this massive outcry against social inequities, the federal government utilized counterintelligence programs called COINTELPRO, conducted by a dozen agencies which aimed to cripple the Black Panther Party and other radical forces. Over the years that these directives were being carried out, many of those targeted young people were put in prisons across the country and became who many of us consider U.S. political prisoners. Some now in their 70s and 80s are still, 60s and 70s, sorry, are still there. In the 1990s, the AFSC began receiving letters from people in street organizations placed in units called Security Threat Group Management Units, known as gang units, also complaining of extreme isolation, brutality, and racial profiling. This is particularly egregious because it is the government which gets to define who a security threat group is, as exampled by the Minnesota and Oregon Departments of Corrections listing Asians, all Asians, as gangs, which Minnesota further compounds by adding Native Americans. The physical and chemical abuse in gang units is infamous to those of us who monitor the torment that these mostly young people of color experience daily. And for those of you who can get HBO on demand, there's a film called an Omar Broadway film, which was filmed secretly at a gang unit in New Jersey. Ogeri, who first contacted us in 1986, was released from the control unit in Jersey via litigation in 2002 after 16 years in extreme isolation. In 2005, he was placed back into the control unit with no explanation. I called maybe 30 people in the New Jersey Department of Corrections, and finally someone said to me, look, this was on the request of Homeland Security, and he slammed the phone down on me. This person spent a total of 22 years in solitary confinement, and we now know that in 2006, the Office of Homeland Security began a program urging administrators to target people that they felt were radical in their beliefs and had the potential to politically radicalize others. The progression of isolation is most recently known as communication management units in federal prisons, which are specifically designed to restrict the communications of imprisoned Muslims and their families with their families, the media, and the outside world. Conditions in the CMUs are so restrictive that the European Court of Human Rights has refused to extradite British nationals to the United States to face terrorism charges because such a move places them at risk of human rights violations. This treatment of prisoners is replicated in U.S. secret prisons throughout the world, where almost all of those kept in such places are people of color. The explosion of control units into supermax prisons has resulted in thousands of mentally ill being housed in sensory deprivation in this country, and we've received and continue to receive hundreds of testimonies, photographs, and drawings on behalf of and from the mentally ill. The proportion of complaints coming from women has risen, describing conditions of confinement, including sexual abuse by staff, with one woman saying, I am tired of being gynecologically examined every time I'm searched. Women have reported the inappropriate use of restraints on pregnant and sick prisoners and being forced into chain gangs. We have received a report about a woman who died of pancreatic disease that went undiagnosed, about a mentally ill woman who was confined naked in a filthy cell where she ingested her own bodily waste, about a woman who suffered burns over 54% of her body, who gradually lost mobility when she was denied the special bandages, and hundreds of others describing trauma and repression. When I think about devices of torture, the testimonies of people imprisoned have widened my understanding that those devices can be anything. They can be the sexual exploitation of women and men, slavery, sadism, the debilitating threat of constant cell extractions, lack of sleep, lack of water, use of drugs, or withdrawal of any of those things necessary for human mental and physical health. The people in prison taught me that devices of torture are more than chemical or physical restraints. They taught me that the psychological abuse is often the worst torture. Abu Ghraib showed the world that the United States has perfected no-touch torture, which is being used every day in U.S. prisons. This can include blinding lights on for 24 hours a day. It can include the never-ending and bleak silence, which can go on for months or years at a time. It can include human cages designed to echo the sound of a faucet dripping or one's own breathing. People have told me the political prisoners speak of knowing that the guards are waiting for them to self-destruct, waiting for their minds to break. Ogeri described the psychological torture of being put in a cell that was covered in fresh blood and being forced to stand still for hours, afraid to move or touch anything. A couple of years ago, I compiled testimony from 11 young people about their experiences in juvenile detention. One young woman described being 12 years old when she went in and being terrified in an isolation cell. And to deal with isolation in children is to deal with suicide issues. Others spoke of physical beatings and forced medication. These past years have been full of thousands of calls and letters with complaints from people in prison and their families describing cold, filth, extended isolation, racism, brutality, and use of devices of torture. I've received vivid descriptions and drawings and photographs of chain gangs, 4 and 5 point restraints, restraint belts, restraint beds, stun grenades, stun guns, stun belts, spit hoods, black boxes which weigh pounds that they tether to someone's wrists, waist and leg chains. In one testimony that I got about 2 months ago, the person described something called a contraband surveillance unit where they tape a diaper onto his bare skin, put him in a plastic suit and taped his ankles and wrists with duct tape. He was not allowed to leave this unit until he had 3 bowel movements. A social worker wrote, John was forced to leave the strip cell and a urine-soaked pillowcase was placed over his head like a hood. He was walked, shackled, and hooded to a different cell where he was placed in a device called the chair, where he was kept for over 30 hours, being forced to urinate and defecate on his own hands, which were tucked under him. Testimonies report the use of stun belts, waist, and leg chains, with one man recently writing that he was secured with 2 additional chains placed on his neck, and he said all of this was done during court dates. He hadn't been convicted of anything yet. Another told of guards shooting stun grenades, this was in a federal prison, through the bars of a central cage which was holding 10 men. The staff used an explosive device to open the doors and entered the unit in gas masks and beat them. The man said, I was then hit in the face with a baton that they call a nigger beater. The Department of Corrections is more than a set of institutions. It is also a state of mind. That state of mind led to Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and conditions and practices in U.S. prisons on all levels here, including juvenile detention facilities, including immigration detention facilities. You cannot give me a reason for the voices of the men, women, and children that come into my life every single day. What is going on in U.S. prisons not only violates the United Nations Convention Against Torture and other U.N. treaties, it is also a profound spiritual crisis that legitimizes demonizing men, women, and children, legitimizes extended isolation, and legitimizes the use of devices of torture. I just want to pause to thank the U.S. Human Rights Network, the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination, and the National Conference of Black Lawyers for helping to rekindle a movement among people who dare to dream of a world without this torture. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Very good information, very good. Next we have Natsu.
Hey. Greetings, and thank you also for putting this together and for all the work you all are doing and for the work you've been doing, Bonnie. That it's difficult to even talk after hearing all the things, just that little overview you've given us, Bonnie, which is so horrific, and we all know to be so true. I wanted, in thinking about how to approach this, because it is so overwhelming and so depressing, I wanted to talk a little bit about the conditions in isolation and supermax prisons and the underlying motivation, because I think that at one level, the conditions have been fairly well documented. You know, we need to always do more of that. They're certainly not thoroughly enough acknowledged, but it's not like that information is not there. It's also true that the psychological effects of these practices, including isolation and sensory deprivation, are very well known and well documented. The law is known, right? We have U.S. law prohibiting torture. We have the findings of these various international bodies, the reports of the Special Rapporteur on Torture, the reports of various U.N. committees and internal human rights groups. And so it's at one level, obvious that there are dramatic violations of both constitutional law and international law. And it's very important, obviously, to keep highlighting these and to bring these out, because showing these contradictions between the stated positions of the United States government and the laws and the actual conditions creates a certain kind of pressure that maintains a certain pressure on the government, you know, maybe not to go as far as they would otherwise like to go, even though they obviously go tremendously far. But I think that what that also tells me is that we have to be looking at the underlying motivations of this behavior by the government, and we have to call out and attack those underlying goals, because, as Bonnie said, the techniques themselves can be anything, right? So if we challenge one technique and manage to get it suppressed in some form, they have a million techniques at their disposal. And so we have to start calling out the underlying of these programs and challenging those. And Bonnie also emphasized earlier or talked about the role of COINTELPRO operations in these programs. And I think we probably all are familiar with the fact that one of the or perhaps the overriding goal of those COINTELPRO operations was to neutralize movements for social change and movements that threaten the status quo. And when we look at why these kinds of torturous conditions are implemented continuously, one major reason is their use for ideological purposes, and the reason they want to attack certain ideologies, certain perspectives, certain, you know, views of the world and attempts to organize people along the lines of those views is that their key goal is to maintain existing hierarchies of power. And if we look at the history of the United States in this regard, of course, we see that this goes all the way back. One of the examples that I think is useful in my thinking about this is if you look at what was done by the U.S. Army to Geronimo and the Chiricahua Apaches and others of the most sort of recalcitrant resistors in the American Indian efforts to resist colonization of their lands and peoples in the 1870s. And those most, the fighters who would not give in were taken to Marion Prison in Florida, and they were put under the supervision of a Colonel Henry Pratt, who started experimenting. I don't know that he was the first one, but he certainly was experimenting in the kinds of conditions that we see in supermax conditions today, in this sort of isolation and total control, and then trying to build in a system of rewards for the kind of behavior that was desired. And he is also the person who was then subsequently put in charge of starting the first American Indian boarding schools. And this was a military operation. I mean, he was a military officer throughout that time. And the other sort of, you know, piece in that American Indian context is that it was only in 1909 that American Indians were legally declared not to be presumptively prisoners of war. And this tells us something, I think, about the way in which resistors are viewed. And, of course, we have parallels, different in their specifics, but significant parallels in the history of African-American enslavement, the use of convict labor, the ways in which prisons and schools, you know, their purposes in society. And so my point is that these aren't only about the appropriation of land and labor and resources, but about forms of social control which facilitate those methods of appropriation. And I think in that context, if we look at how people who are labeled terrorists or gangs or radical Islamists or whatever the labels are that they are giving to the peoples that are prioritized for special housing units, for control units, for supermax prisons, we see that it is really about attacking ideas, it's about attacking philosophies of life, it's about attacking religion, it's about attacking political understandings and organizations and trying to undermine those from the beginning. There's been interesting, you know, if we look at how in these supermax control units, for example, you know, they're supposed to be these step-down programs where people can support their life by engaging in certain behavior. But what that really means, especially with respect to a lot of the political prisoners that we're talking about, is they have to give up, renounce their political beliefs, maybe their religion. They have to agree to snitch out other people. They have to serve as informants. They have to do everything they can that to undermine the movements that they're part of, to undermine the belief systems that they're part of, and to both, you know, show that, that they personally are not who they were when they went in, and that they are going to help keep prevent other people from being who they are. And that's a very distinct violation, I think, of human rights generally and the laws that I don't think we've focused on enough. And one of the reasons I think we need to is because I think it will help us to get to a level of not just fighting each particular torture tactic, but the underlying structures of torture in prisons. And I think one of the things that I'd like to see us do is, at least, you know, be talking about more and addressing how we can do it, is to talk about this issue of identity and belief, religion. For an example, one of the reasons that was given, you all know that Imam Jamil al-Amin was sort of unexpectedly, to us anyway, right, transferred from state custody in Georgia to federal custody and is now in the supermax prison in Florence. And one of the reasons that the state of Georgia gave for that was that other prisoners in the Georgia system had requested that he be their imam. Right, so that's their reason for putting him in extreme conditions of isolation in Colorado. But what could he do to change that? Right, the only thing he could do to change that was to become somebody different to who he is, so that other people wouldn't want him to be their imam. I mean, it doesn't make any sense in a logical way, but it makes a great deal of sense in a political control framework. And also, I think we see that with the gangs, right? The gangs are not often don't have sort of political ideology that might be as coherent as the political prisoners that we're talking about, but they are forms of social organization and networking that are threatening to the structures of power because those so-called gang formations either already do or have the potential to represent real movements for social change. And so what I'm hoping that one of the things we might address is how this system as a whole constitutes not only violations of all the specific laws, the torture convention, et cetera, all of which is extremely important to bring out, but also attacks on basic fundamental human rights that relate to speech, thought, association, religion, identity, which then gets us into also the analysis of genocide, because genocide, you know, one of the definitions of genocide is any attempt to eliminate a racial, national, ethnic, or religious, social group as such, as what it is, right? And if you are not allowed to have particular religious views, particular political views, et cetera, you know, that's falling into that category of illegitimate state action. And the final thing I just wanted to say, and then I'll stop, is that I think that as we approach this, we also have to discuss the issue of the abdication of state responsibility through the privatization of prisons, because the state, you know, international law has historically been state-focused, and the state has certain recognized powers, and what we're saying is they are not complying with these and need to be held responsible under international law as well as under domestic law. And it is sort of recognized, but not as clearly implemented, that they also have a responsibility to oversee, you know, if they're going to farm out things to private corporations, the state still has responsibility for the behavior of those private corporations. But that is, in fact, in practice, it doesn't work at all, as we know. But it's a way of watering down the state responsibility and making, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think we have to challenge that as well, because that is one of the methods through which they are avoiding accountability under law. So those are just some ideas I wanted to toss out there, and I will turn it back over to you, Colleen.
Thank you, Natsu. Just one last comment is going to come from Afia, just explaining the Universal Peer Act review process and the work that the Political Prisoner and State Repression Working Group is doing on that. So Afia, if you can just give us a couple minutes on that, and then we'll go straight into the question and answer period.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for being here, and it's such an honor to be participating and presenting with Natsu and with Bonnie, two longtime stalwart scholar activists who presented very useful information that allows us to be able to put into context the standards and the ways in which these standards are being violated by the United States. On November 5th, the Hillary Clinton U.S. Secretary of State and Attorney General Eric Holder will be representing the United States in its first human rights compliance assessment by the UN's Universal Periodic Review Working Group, a working group of the United Nations' Human Rights Council, which is the body that came into formation after the United States successfully discredited and worked to dismantle the Human Rights Commission, which was formed at the founding of the United Nations. And of course, it was discredited because of its criticism of the United States. The review will be a public interactive dialogue between Clinton and Holder and member and observer states of the council based on reports submitted by the United States government, the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and individual and organizational U.S. stakeholders. The U.S. report is available at the U.S. Human Rights Network website, along with the 24 stakeholder report, combined report, or joint report that the network has submitted to the UN. And the High Commissioner's report is a combination of the reports of special rapporteurs that it has appointed over the years, along with a review of the U.S. report and of the stakeholders' report. So publicly, the United States will have to address questions that are generated as a result of the combined review of those three reports. The working group sits in Geneva and is composed of 47 regional member states or countries, and that's geographical, hemispheric, racial, class, so that there's a broad cross-section that's represented in the council. At the end of the review, that three-hour session on November 5th, the working group adopts an outcome document with recommendations. That outcome document is drafted within hours of the review, and it's subsequently considered and adopted by the Human Rights Council at a later session, which we believe will probably be in March. The United States will indicate recommendations that it supports or accepts, and these, among others, not limited to just the ones it accepts, become the basis for future evaluations. under the auspices of the U.S. Human Rights Network's UPR project, COINTELPRO Civil Rights Era Political Prisoners, Prisoners of War, and Exiles have been cited, and the continuing or continuum, as it's titled, of domestic repression, among other issues, has been submitted for the United States' examination. And I appreciate Natsu going all the way back to the invasion of the Western Hemisphere. We did a little of that in the Black August discussion, but the greater detail fills in the gaps that were left there. The standards to which the United States will be held are the documents to which all members of the United Nations are held, and those standards to which it has signed on, treaties, conventions, and other commitments, as well as its own representations. The UPR will assess the extent to which the United States respects human rights obligations as represented by the UN Charter, its compliance with the UN Charter, Universal Declaration of Human Rights instruments to which the United States is a party. Namely, this will include the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, or CERD as it's commonly called, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the Convention Against Torture, or CAT, as it's commonly called, and is the topic of today's session. Its voluntary pledges and commitments that it has made, the United States consistently refers to the U.S. Constitution, Constitution of Rights, federal statutes, and state adherence to those, the Constitution and statutes, as basis for accepting itself from various other obligations and treaties that it would otherwise be called upon to sign on to. Once the outcome document has been approved by the Council, then the United States is expected to develop systems and entities to implement and to address the issues that are raised in the outcome document. However, as one of the presenters pointed out, this gets to be handed off or outsourced, which gives the government arguable, plausible deniability for failure to perform. Thus, We continue to be, we meaning civil society, continue to be that force that is necessary to monitor and to hold the United States to the standards to which it has at least minimally publicly committed. Also, it becomes our duty to, when the United States continues to fail to meet those obligations, to call its hand publicly and to use one of the devices that has proven so successful across the board, and that is shaming, to embarrass the United States, to put it bluntly, by pointing out that it is not only not the standard bearer of human rights for the globe, but that it, in its hypocrisy, it has done great harm to people here and people abroad. I want to especially note the contradiction in the United States report, where it points to the fact that the president of the United States is of African descent, that the attorney general is Black, that two of the past four attorney generals have been Black, and two women. However, it does not recognize the fact that political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles that paved the way for that celebrated occurrence, remain locked down in prisons under the most draconian circumstances, and yet the United States continues to not only deny their existence, but to lecture the rest of the world on what it calls political prisoners and prisoners of war. I will stop here and answer questions, give more information based on the questions that are asked. I would again urge going to the U.S. Human Rights Network website, where there is further information and detail with regard to the UPR process. I would call your attention to the website database, upr-info.org, which will provide information about the kinds of questions that other governments have had to answer and whose sympathies we will be seeking in order to have them to raise with the United States the questions that we believe should be raised, most particularly those questions regarding political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles, and the ongoing repression that's actually escalating in the United States and that was described in the form of torture by our earlier presenters.
All right, thank you, Afia. And again, thank you, Bonnie.
Colleen?
Yeah. Can you hear me? Okay. So just want to now go into the question and answer period. And so if anyone has any questions or comments and would like to get on the queue,
hello?
Press star 1. Greetings, Jihad. Do you have a question?
Yes. Greetings, everybody. Bonnie, Natsu, and Sia, and you, my brother. I have one question, which really is for all three presenters, but starting, I guess, with Sia, and I'm going to ask the question repeatedly. But in that UPR process, even talking to Bonnie a couple of times on the phone about it, you know, because my main concern was, first of all, I think it's excellent what we're doing, all of you guys. I mean, this whole thing is profound. And it's very, very, very important where we are right now. But what do you want people to do now? I'm listening. You know, right now I'm acting chairman of Jericho. And, you know, other organization representatives are listening. A lot of people, you know, are going to be tuned in. Even those who are not listening, they're going to speed with them. What could we be doing now that this process is off and running and you set dates out that this is going to happen and this is going to happen? What do you see us doing now to build on this? Good positive.
Thank you for the question. Fia, Natsu, Bonnie, anybody want to cover that?
I'm sorry, I got disconnected. What was the question?
Yeah, you want to repeat it?
Yeah, the question was, what can people do now to assist in this whole process about the UPR and everything that was stated? You know, people are listening. What can we do? Some people are more suited to do more in terms of organizations. Like I said, acting chairman of Jericho right now. But what do you see us doing to help out this process?
I would say that the first thing is to begin to organize on a local basis. And call attention to the UPR, the existence of the UPR process, and to engage people in self-education. We want people on November 5th to be prepared to make the issue of political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles visible. That means going to embassies, consulates, federal buildings on November 5th, pointing out that there are political prisoners in the United States. Leading up to that, we will be identifying, will be sympathetic, and that will address the issue or raise the questions of political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles during that 3-hour public exchange between Holder and Clinton and the member states participating in the council. It's also in terms of local organization to recognize that we have to be prepared to work beyond November 5th so that the using this time leading up to November 5th as a way of developing an infrastructure that will be used thereafter ought be the vision for what we do at this point in time. Some of us have international contacts. We have been in touch with countries in the Caribbean in particular, where activists are contacting their foreign ministries and expressing support for the political prisoner state repression report and urging their government to support the questions and to raise the questions as we present them to their representatives appearing in Geneva. There will be also a petition that will be put online, and everyone who's participating in the calls will receive notices in order to generate signatures that can be attached and presented at the time that we go to Geneva to lobby more intensely the various countries that will be present at the time of the examination and that will be in the best position to raise the questions. So as time progresses, we will develop a toolkit which will have a list of activities from which folks can choose either individually or organizationally to help to move the issue forward. One of the proposals that we've gotten has come from Jaleel Montekine, asking that political prisoners' books be made available at least for viewing at the time of the in November at the time of the side events, and Kali can talk more about the side events, but we will be needing assistance in getting copies of those books to be able to take with us and to be able to give to government. Government representatives attending. So we will need funds in order to be able to do that. So fundraising for that purpose can also be considered. I don't want to add too much more to that without having consulted the rest of the members of the working group, but these are points that we have already come together on.
All right, thank you for that, Afia. I want to get to, just in the interest of time, get to the next question. We're also going to put a few more suggestions out there about how people can get involved and reiterate those points towards the end of the call. Okay, the next person we have was Christina.
Yes. Actually, my question was, I actually got on the call a little late. Yeah, I wanted to find out if there were any contact numbers for the speakers that have spoken this afternoon. I have an organization currently that has 4,000 members, and we would really like to get involved in this process, and I'd like to be able to speak with those who would be some of the decision makers. The name of my organization is Project Rise Up, and so we're actually doing a lot of, you know, where a lot of activism is going on right now, so we want to know what we can do to support this effort, and obviously, again, to ask for those who may be able to talk with us a little bit more about what we can do in the upcoming days toward November 5th.
Okay. I'm one of the people that you would be getting in contact with, Christina. This is Kali Okuno with the U.S. Human Rights Network.
Kali.
And you can, it's K-A-L-I,
mm-hmm.
A-K-U-N-O, and you can reach me either via email at kakuno at ushrnetwork.org, or you can also reach me at 510 593-3956. And I would also encourage you and everyone else, if you're, as I mentioned earlier in the call, if you're not receiving biweekly information from us, to email me, you know, that you want to be part of this kind of a contact stream, and we'll make sure you're included in that information. And there's a broad range of folks that you can get in contact with that deal with some of these issues.
Kali, would you spell your email address for me once again, please?
It's K.
Mm-hmm.
A-K-U-N-O.
A-K-U-N-O.
At U.S.
At U.S.
H-R.
H-R.
Network.
Network.
.org.
Plural or?
.org.
Is that network or network?
Network.
Okay.
Yes, it's our network.
Kali, if I might add to that, we encourage people to join the working group for political prisoners, prisoners of war and exiles, and state repression. So that people who are interested in joining the working group should also contact Kali, or you can reach me at enjericho@gmail.com. That's enjericho@gmail.com. There is a third call which we will be having that focuses exclusively on COINTELPRO, and the date for that has not at this point been set, but we will be sending out notices to everyone generally, and especially people who participated on the call, when that date is set.
Okay. I'm sorry, your name again?
My name is Ifdia Wangaza. And my email, Ifdia is E as in equal, F as in freedom, I as in independent, A as in African.
Got it.
My email address is enjericho@gmail.com.
Okay. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Next we have TJ.
This is TJ Whitaker, and I'm working with the Jericho Movement and New Jersey Jericho locally. But I'm actually coming at this from two perspectives. I'm preparing a dissertation proposal for a PhD study at Rutgers University. So I want to ask with regard to test cases and access to reports, what would people suggest as far as a direction for the dissertation? And then also if I can count on folks with help as far as information, testimony, possible interviews, and things of that sort. As far as the dissertation.
Wow. That's
and Bonnie and you can also weigh in. I'm sorry.
Well, TJ and I are in contact. TJ, do you want to just say the title of your dissertation?
Or? Sure. Towards U.S. torture in U.S. prisons. And I was looking to focus the test cases possibly on political prisoners. And a lot of the testimony that we're hearing from, is not necessarily political prisoners per se. But I was looking to, as far as the dissertation, in order to hopefully gain some support and recognition to focus the test cases on political prisoners.
This is Natsu. I would be happy and... You know, I don't know, maybe Kali, you could send out some of our contact information to the group that's on this call.
Yeah, I can do that.
To make it more efficient.
Okay.
But,
and I'll definitely, I'm planning on doing.
I was just going to say, I'd be happy to try to get you information about some of the Supermax cases. Like, there are some specific cases that are being filed about the conditions of confinement, et cetera. And while they're not labeled political prisoner cases, for the most part, that's easier.
Exactly.
I'd be happy to be in contact with you about that.
Okay.
And I don't know how far back you want to go in terms of history, but there were hearings held in the 90s,
yep.
in the early to mid-90s, and there's a lot of that testimony that's available.
I mean, your point about the 70s and 80s with the control units beginning, again, there's a historical component to the program, and so, I mean, I could go back as far as you know, we need to. But I just want the document to have the most impact with regard to raising awareness. You know, it's more a movement document than anything else. And so I just wanted to, you know, have it be the most effective piece that we can, you know, put together. I'm going to join the working group, and Kali, I'm going to send you an email so that I can get those biweekly updates. But I just wanted to touch base with everybody. I'll be in touch with Natso and Bonnie. We're already.
All right. Thank you, TJ. And we'll be in contact yep. with you because we're also going to be doing an expanded report.
Yep.
You know, based upon this, and we'd like to, you know, get yours and other folks' contributions to that. So be on the lookout for that as well.
Let me add that we also have certain needs that the project needs in terms of research. And so we'd like to have a further conversation once we've had a sense of where we are and what our possibilities are and what his capabilities are in that regard.
I want to get to the next question. I have DJ Rage.
How's it going, family? First, I wanted to thank you for all your participation in the struggle for our people. And with what's going on with Mumia, I guess they have a hearing or something on the 9th of November. I was wondering if there's anything else going along with that. Is that in kind of conjunction with the action going to be taken on the 5th? And then I have a follow-up comment after that.
There are only two cases among our recommendations that are expressly named, and Mumia is one of them. The call that has been made, consistent with his own, is for a new trial, his along with Leonard Peltier, while we make calls, similar calls, for the class of political prisoners. His name is specifically mentioned.
I also want to provide myself as a resource. I have a media group. We do radio shows and other things of the like. And basically, when we're disseminating information, our people don't have many choices. We always have to use underground methods, phone calls, the activists you've been working with. I mean, we can't count on any other resources to provide this information out there. I mean, of course we can't count on places like BET or anybody else. But I want to provide ourselves as a resource. We would love to speak to many of y'all on the phone, different organizations, those who are participating in this political prisoner movement, and get this information out there to more and more people. So I guess when you provide the contact information, I would definitely get in contact with y'all and love to push more of this out there. All right.
That's really great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Will the network be providing contact information, Colleen?
We can definitely send out the contact information to the entire group for the folks who participated in this call. We can definitely do that.
That's great. And I wanted to say one thing that I was thinking about when Bonnie started talking about local organizing in response to the first question, but I think it is relevant to this kind of broad-based media work as well, and that's that. You know, it's as we highlight the importance of political prisoners, prisoners of war, persons in exile, which is critical, especially in light of the United States hypocrisy about those issues, I also think that, you know, we need to keep relating it back to the large base, you know, the 2 million plus people, because that, you know, the U.S. having the highest incarceration rate on the planet has been used as a tool of dismantling effective community organizing and effective community movements, but it's also a tool for us because if there's 2 million folks in prison, that means a huge portion of the population is related
closely to somebody in prison and can relate to these issues. And I think we need to sort of start turning that dynamic around, you know, using it to tie those folks at the local level into this broader movement.
Let me point out that while these calls are focused on political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles, the report that was filed by the U.S. Human Rights Network has 24 or 22 other, 24 including these two, reports, one of which focuses exclusively on the criminal punishment system, both as it relates to adults and to juveniles, and is a part of the presentation that will be made in our lobbying efforts in Geneva. So it's not that we or the network has overlooked it. It's just that this component is focused on political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles. But as a part of the overall work of the network, you're absolutely right, and we are attentive to it.
Yeah, I didn't mean to imply that you weren't. I was just thinking in terms of, you know, what can we do at the local level? It's like the integration of those seems to be really critical to me. I didn't want to imply you.
I agree. And a part of how, when I first started doing the work, the AFSU was not receptive to political prisoner work, so I chose isolation. Is there a role in this for organizational letters or organizational statements to the U.S. Human Rights Network?
I would certainly think so. You know, part of the petition process would be a perfect place for that to be included. If you'll recall earlier on back in April when we did the initial stakeholder reports, we thought both individual and organizational. While it won't have the same level of involvement in the formal process, it will be very helpful in the lobbying process because it allows us to show the breadth of community support and concern for the issues that we're raising. So absolutely.
All right, wanted to get to our last statement of comment. This is from Bill. Bill, you still there?
Did you say Bill?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, but this is actually going back to several comments ago, but I think it's relevant to what's been said since. Is about, I think it was TJ who was writing a dissertation, and I just wanted to mention that one case that has been very major case here on the West Coast has been the San Francisco 8 case, which goes back to 8 Black Panthers who were busted in the early 70s, confessions tortured out of them, and then their case dropped based on the fact that the confessions were gotten by torture, and then they were rearrested more than 35 years later. Anyhow, I think that would be an important source for you to get information about torture of political prisoners. And one of the San Francisco 8 is whose charges have been dropped, Richard Brown, will be in Geneva at this UPR to talk more about that.
Anybody got any feedback on that? And also, if there are any more questions, again, the process, just hit star one on your phone. All right. Natsu or Bonnie or Afia, any closing comments before we close out? We'll close out with a couple of announcements, but any final thoughts?
I think just to piggyback on, I guess, both Afia and Natsu, that this what's going on is not over by a long shot. And those of us who work on behalf of political prisoners, not only do they feel the ongoing repression that's been picked up by Homeland Security, but activists continue to feel it. I've recently been called on the carpet by AFSC. Ojeri Lotulo, who I talked about, was disappeared off a train in January and has a civil suit pending. And I'm sure that there are a dozen other incidents that I don't know about. What I do know about is what's happening to Muslims in prisons and outside, you know, through what's going on, through the repression at Homeland Security. So this is, and what Bill said about the San Francisco 8, this is so current, so vital.
Okay, actually, we have, thank you for that, Bonnie. We have one, and this would be the final question or comment for Metro.
Greetings. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes. Okay. Actually, Christina asked a little bit of information, but what I was going to do is give the website for Project Rise Up for the information I was speaking about earlier. It's projectriseup.com, and there's several cases on that site with information and everything. I got to say, I really enjoyed what I heard today, and it's good to know that the struggle is not a struggle because we're going to make this happen. I just needed to get your complete phone number again because I got part of it, but I didn't get it all.
My phone number, Mitchell?
Yes, Kali, sir.
Again, for everybody, it's 510-593-3956. And you can also reach me at my office number, which is 404-588-9761.
Thank you very much, Gordon.
All right. Not to any closing points?
No, I just want to say thank you. It's an honor to participate in this in even a small way, and I hope that I'll be happy if there's any resources that I can help people get in touch with.
All right, thank you. And I want to thank everybody for calling in today and joining us, and definitely want to encourage everybody to stay in contact with us and to visit the network's website, which is www.ushrnetwork.org, and be on the lookout for our next call on COINTELPRO. It'll be towards the end of October. We're going to nail down those dates very shortly. And also for folks to be on the lookout for the COINTELPRO movie, if you're particularly in the Bay Area, that Freedom Archives is working on now. So, again, thank everybody for joining us.
And
hope to hear from you
soon. In Atlanta, too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Join the working group. Join the working group.
Right on for you.